I speak in the name of one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Please be seated. There are some sermons that you just work on longer than others. Typically, you have about a week to work on a sermon from one Sunday to the next. The readings change every week, and you typically spend about 1 week preparing your sermon. But there are a few instances where you just spend a lot longer. Those are typically Easter and Christmas, where you start working on the other one right after the last season had passed. So I've been working on my Christmas sermon, at least it's been in the back of my mind, since Easter Monday. And my Easter sermon will be in my mind starting December 25th, after the chaos of Christmas has passed in my house with my young children. I'll start thinking about my Easter sermon. And you just spend a lot of time thinking about them. The other one that clergy spend a lot of time thinking on is the stewardship sermon. And this, we are asked every year to preach on a stewardship sermon, and this week is the stewardship week for a sermon. And the reason it's hard to preach on is not because the topic of stewardship is overly hard to preach on, but it's because you have to do it at a specific time period. And sometimes what happens is the lectionary readings, which are set every year, that's on a 3-year cycle, I don't get to pick them, they're set every year. Sometimes those readings seem to have very little to do with stewardship. And then you have a stewardship season that runs in the fall, and you have to preach about stewardship with readings that have nothing to do with stewardship. And it can feel like you're preaching to the theme versus preaching to the text and trying to meld them both, and it just doesn't go well. And then every 3 years, Matthew gives us a fabulous gift, and preachers across the country just sigh a thing of relief when we get this reading, because this is the stewardship reading. And this happens towards the end of Jesus's life, which is why we read it in the fall, because we reset telling Jesus's life, Advent 1, which typically begins the last Sunday of November or the first Sunday in December, the way Easter falls, depending on that. So it always falls in the fall, which is fantastic, because I would be very frustrated if this perfect stewardship sermon and reading fell in like July, when we're not talking about stewardship. But thankfully, it comes in the fall. And this is the perfect sermon and reading to talk about stewardship. And essentially what happens is we're in Holy Week of Jesus's life. We're in the final week of Jesus's life. And we've been in it for a while, at least a month. We've been hanging out in the last week of Jesus's life. And there is a lot that happens during that last week of Jesus's life. And Matthew spends quite a lot of time, almost an entire third of the Gospel of Matthew, focuses on the last week of Jesus's life and then Easter and resurrection stories. And so what we have is we have Jesus riding in to Jerusalem on a donkey, Palm Sunday, as we all know. Jesus comes into Jerusalem riding on a donkey. He gets off the donkey. He immediately goes to the temple, where he sees that there are money changers. They're changing money for people to come, and they're charging people a fee to change their money. And he flips over the tables. He takes out a whip, and he drives them out of the temple with the whip, saying, "You are turning my father's house into a den of robbers." And then he leaves. And he comes back to the temple another day, still in Holy Week, like probably Monday, he comes back to the temple. And the Pharisees and scribes who are in charge of that temple kind of delicately approach Jesus and says, "Jesus, by what authority are you doing these things?" Mainly because the last time Jesus was there, he threw over tables and drove them out with a whip, and they don't want that to repeat itself. So they're asking Jesus about his authority. Jesus gives them two parables, the parable of two sons, one that goes into the vineyard to work after he says that he won't, and one that doesn't go into the vineyard when he says he will work. And he asks them, "Who does the will of the Father?" The Pharisees answer correctly, saying, "The one who went even when he said he wouldn't." Then he tells them the parable of the vineyard with the wine press, where you have the wicked tenants who mistreat the slaves who come to collect the harvest. The landowner sends his son. They also mistreat and kill the son. The Pharisees and scribes know that Jesus is talking about it, and that they know that Jesus is talking about them, and they want to arrest Jesus. That's how the parable ends. They want to arrest Jesus, but they don't, because people regarded him as a prophet. So now they want to entrap Jesus. They want to be able to arrest Jesus. They want to catch him saying the wrong thing. So they pose a question: is it lawful to pay taxes? So the Jewish leaders are asking this question, the Pharisees, their disciples. They're asking, is it lawful to pay taxes? And we're in Matthew's gospel, and if you remember, Matthew is a tax collector. And what happens with tax collectors is they collect the tax for the Roman Empire, and then they charge something on top of it, and they kind of skim the top. So people are paying more than their fair share of taxes. And the Jewish people overall do not like paying taxes. They don't feel like the taxes are working for them. They're paying more than they should be in fair taxes. Their answer, they want Jesus to say, because he's Jewish, is no, it's not right to pay taxes. But that's going to get Jesus in trouble with the Roman Empire, meaning the Roman Empire would then want to arrest him. And if he says, yes, taxes are great, that's going to get him in trouble with the Jews. And then they can arrest him for violating Jewish law. So they want to entrap him. They want Jesus to answer a yes or a no question. And either way, whichever one he gives will get him in trouble with one party or the other. That's how they've entrapped him. They've created a no-win situation. He cannot answer this question correctly. And one side or the other will be upset enough that they could actually arrest Jesus. To be clear, the people who come to him today are the Jewish leaders, the Pharisees and Herodians. They've come to him to entrap him. They want to arrest him on Jewish law, that he's not following Jewish custom correctly. The people who will arrest him on Maundy Thursday at the end of his life is the Roman Empire. We're talking about two different people. So the people who will arrest Jesus and put him to death are not the same people that are trying to entrap him today. So we have the question is it lawful to pay taxes? And Jesus says, show me the coin that's used. And they bring him a denarius, a small coin, and he asks whose face is on it and whose title. And in those days, the coins were printed every time there was a new emperor or a new Caesar. And they were printed with that Caesar's face and the name of the Caesar on it. And they say it's the emperor's. And he said, well, give to the emperor what is at the emperor's and give to God what is God's. Which is the perfect answer. He didn't answer the question, but he answered the question. This is one of the few questions where Jesus actually answers. There's three in the entire Bible. This is one of them. He actually answers this question. But he answers it in a perfect way where he didn't actually technically answer it, but he answered it enough that they can't actually arrest him. But the whole point is, what exactly is the emperor's that is not already God's? What does the emperor have or possess that is solely the emperor's, that first did not belong to God? Because the answer is nothing. Everything from the emperor's is already God's. Everything that we already have is already God's. All that we have should be given back to God. St. Stephen's in Westboro celebrated their 125th celebration as a church this year. You guys have a lot more years on them, for the record. I don't remember off the top of my head how many are, but you're well into the 200s. But they celebrated their 125th this year, and there was a celebratory dinner where people got up and they talked about the memories that they have of St. Stephen's. They talked about the things that they carried. These are people who still attend the church, but there were also people who have moved away. And they came and they told stories about the church, of what they love about St. Stephen's. And all of them had kind of one common theme, which was a community of people who loved them, who celebrated joys with them, but also in the hardest times of their life, they stood by them and grieved with them and did not allow them to face their trials alone. Every story had a theme of community. And I didn't give my story for St. Stephen's that night because, frankly, I wasn't quite prepared. This was a spur-of-the-moment thing where people told stories and I wasn't prepared to tell a story, so I didn't tell them a story that day. I told them a story this morning of my favorite memory of St. Stephen's. And so this morning, I want to share my favorite memory of St. Paul's with you all. I started in St. Paul's in September of 2021, which was a particularly difficult time in my personal life. The technical letter of agreement started on September 1st, but my first Sunday with you was that second Sunday of the month. In between the second and fourth Sunday, you obviously have the third Sunday of the month. The third Sunday of September 2021, that Sunday morning, at about 8 a.m., my father-in-law had a massive stroke. So much so that I didn't actually go to church at St. Stephen's. I called Beth, who was the deacon at the time, around an hour before service started and said, I can't come, Beth. You have to take care of it, which she did. She did a fabulous job. But that week, my husband was already at church that Sunday morning. He had already gone to church. He had a 10 a.m. service. We lived far away. He had already driven in. There was a vestry meeting prior to it. He was unavailable, is the point. He was in multiple church services while his father was having a stroke. They took my father-in-law by ambulance to the hospital in Sturbridge, diagnosed that he was having a stroke, and then airlifted him from Sturbridge to UMass. In the time that it took the helicopter to get from Sturbridge to UMass, we're on the phone with the neurologist who was talking about doing a surgery to relieve the clot. And I'm with my mother-in-law and sister-in-law, and I learned something about them this day. They have a lot of gifts and talents. One of them is not making decisions quickly in the moment. I am really great in a crisis. I can make decisions fast and I can stick by those decisions. So as we're on the phone with the neurologist, as the helicopter's landing, the neurologist is literally standing by waiting for my father-in-law to come. And the neurologist says to my mother-in-law, you have to decide. Are we going to do the surgery or are you going to let him die? The surgery is likely to not be successful, and if it is, he will likely have major deficits. We need to make a decision. And my mother-in-law says, can't we just wait until I get there? Can't I just see him? We're like 25 minutes away. And Norella says, no, you have no time. You need to make the decision now. Every second that we wait, brain cells are dying. You must make this decision now. And she was unable to do so. And I had to make the decision for my family about what we would do. Which is really hard when it's your own family, but it's nearly impossible when it's your family-in-law. Because I love them, but they're not my family of origin. I know very well what my family would want me to do in that situation. These are not conversations I've had with my father-in-law about what he would want done in this situation. So we make the decision, we do the surgery is successful. The next week I come to church, it's the fourth Sunday of the month, it's my second Sunday with you all, and I think I'm here just by sheer will and autopilot at this point. We also moved that week. For the record, we moved our house. The week that my father-in-law had a stroke was Sunday, we moved that Thursday. It was chaos. And I come to church and I'm pretty sure I'm just on autopilot at that point. Like I'm just going through the motions. I know what I'm gonna do. I know what I'm gonna say. And then somebody asks me before the church service, how are you doing? How are you doing? It's great to see you. Just common pleasantry. And I unload on them because I'm not doing well. That's the honest answer. I'm not doing well. I am completely and totally overwhelmed. And for most of the time, I fake it. On Sunday morning, if I don't feel very well or something's happened, I'm like, I'm great, it's so great to see you all. But that morning, the only thing I could do was show up as my most human self, which wasn't okay. And I said that. And what I was met with overwhelming kindness and compassion. They stopped, they prayed, they continued to pray for months and weeks and years after. You guys know the name of my father and my mother-in-law because they have been in your prayers regularly. My favorite moment of St. Paul's was one of the hardest moments of my life because you are a church that showed me great kindness and compassion. Because sometimes the best that your clergy people can do is show up as their human self. That's not all put together and not all great and doesn't really know how they're going to get through the next hour of their life in the service. You have allowed me to be who I am. It is a gift that I cannot give back to you. You have given me a gift that I simply cannot repay. Your kindness and your grace and your compassion to me is greater than anything that I have ever experienced. So when we talk about stewardship, we give money in kind of three ways, time, talent, and treasure, right? Your time is when you come to church on Sunday morning, you volunteer for things like vestry, or you volunteer to help with coffee hour or things like that. You give time to the church. You garden. You help hold the weeds. You make sure that everything's set up on Sunday. Then you have talent. The altar guild sets up things for church to make sure that things are beautiful. You have the readers who read in church. You have people who help lead the service. On the first of every month, you have morning prayer. And the third of the month, you're going to have morning prayer again. You have people who give their talent to the church. And you have treasure, which is the financial piece of it. And there's an important piece of financial piece given to the church because it does things like keep the lights on. And we're coming into the heating months. It means that, you know, we're not all here shivering in our coats. And in the summer months, we get fans running. And there is an important aspect to the treasure of the church. But however you give to the church, whether you give your time, your talent, or your treasure to the church, the one thing that's important to know is that you give to the community of this church. You give to St. Paul's. You give to what makes this church unique and special. You give to a community of people who do not allow you to go through the hardest trials of your life alone, but also the people who will rejoice with you at the same level of excitement they would have for the joys in their own life. You give to a community that loves and cherishes the people. That's what you give to when you give to St. Paul's. And going all the way back to what we heard in our gospel reading today, when the question is posed, should we pay taxes? And Jesus says, give to the emperor what is the emperor, and then give to God's what is God's. Everything that we have is already God's. All we're doing is simply giving it back to him. Amen.